play all the same old songs. Why do you sing with the melody? 'Cause down on the street, something's going on. There's a brand new beat and a brand new song. In my life, there was so much anger. Still, I have no regrets. Just like you, I was such a rebel. So dance your own dance and never forget. Every generation has its way. I need to dance so big. N'oubliez jamais. It's in your destiny. I need to disagree. Who's getting in the way? N'oubliez jamais.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Sunday edition. Today's date is December 3rd, 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here with me tonight. It's nighttime in my little French village here, and we have some important information to share with you. Of course, as usual, when we do an interview, we're trying to break some new ground, or at least bring together disparate parts of a story. Before we go right into that, I want to talk to you about this this recent win we had on the MySpace, being the number one political cause, and won that handily against a group called Tabs for Life. Now, I must apologize to Tabs for Life for calling them Save the Chickens. I shouldn't have done that, and I apologize. You're not Save the Chickens, and you're certainly not peddling drugs over there, or you know, tabbing people. And I apologize for that. It was a flippant comment, and probably definitely off color. So I owe you an apology. You know, sometimes my mouth works before my brain does, and I apologize for that. As for what's going on in both Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, what we've discovered over a long period of time and a lot of research is that this has been a plan for a very long time. It was first put into operation in Serbia. Now, for those of you who are not, I mean, many of us couldn't even find the old Yugoslavia on a map when things were going on over there. And, of course, we bought hook, line, and sinker the story that was being propelled across our airwaves. However, the goal there was to break up the Yugoslavia into into component parts or ethnic parts. They were very successful at doing that. It even took on its own name called Balkanization. And this same strategy is being employed in the Middle East. And what you must understand is that when the Middle East was the country boundaries were delineated, they were cut right through ethnic areas between Kurds in the north, and there were some Kurds over in Iran and some in Turkey. And then we went right through the Shia area from southern Iran over into, in other words, ladies and gentlemen, there was no cohesion among communities according to the lines of their nation. In other words, they were fabricated boundaries that were put together by the British over 100 years ago. And if you think this stuff doesn't have a plan to it, we're going to bring on our favorite journalist here and somebody who's worked with us regularly to get the truth out. His name's Christopher Bolin. You're all well aware of Chris's work and his reputation. And I want to bring him up right now. Chris, are you with me?
Yeah, hello, Daryl. Can you hear me?
I sure can, Chris. You know, the situation of Balkanization. Can you give people a snapshot of the last time they did this with Serbia and some of the strange facts that came out of that once research was done on the whole thing?
Yeah, sure. It's very interesting. Balkanization is a philosophy or a strategy that was articulated clearly by an Israeli foreign ministry official named Oded Yinon. He did a paper in 1982, and like I said, he had been in the Israeli foreign ministry, and he wrote a paper about the Balkanization as being the end-game strategy of the Israelis and the Zionists, and that is to break up the larger countries of the Middle East, virtually every one of them, into ethnic statelets. like what they did in Yugoslavia. Now, I want to tell you something that's very interesting about this. I was studying, was working on my degree in history. I was studying the Middle East, Palestine and Israel, at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And we had one professor there, his name was Edmund Burke, Terry Burke. Mm-hmm. And he's a pretty good Middle Eastern guy, and I was working on Palestine and Israel, and I was virtually the only one that wasn't a Zionist. And in 1990, I started a movement against the encroaching war against Iraq in the fall of 1990. And in August 1990, Terry Burke came back from a sabbatical at Princeton, where he had studied. And he studied under Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis is basically sort of like the dean of Middle Eastern studies for the elite schools in the United States. Bernard Lewis is basically a British Jew who is, of course, a very Zionist Jew. And he writes all kinds of books about Islam, what have you. But he's a Zionist. And when Terry Burke came back in August of 1990, now this is before any wars had broken out in the Balkans or in the Middle East, and Terry Burke stood there in front of the university, in front of the federal building in Santa Cruz, and the first words out of his mouth were Balkanization.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting. And I was in my last year or so of getting my degree in Middle Eastern history, and he gave me this book, Crossing the River Drina, The Bridge Across the River Drina, I think it's called. And it's a book about these the ethnic problems in Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm from Chicago. It's not that far away, because we've always had Serbs and Croats fighting in Chicago over, you know, which is who and what. But the thing is that what's apparent, and I called Terry Burke about this last time I was in California, is that this concept of Balkanization was being foisted, was being talked to elite professors as the strategy for the Middle East already in the summer of 1990.
And you said there was a white paper in 82 put forth?
Yes. Yes. I was just checking on Eric Hoofschmidt's website, or your website, I think it was imthewitness.com. I was looking at that because one of my papers was up there about Balkanization. I've written a lot about it. And the guy that wrote it, his name is Oded, O-D-E-D, is an Israeli, Oded Yinon, Y-I-N-O-N.
Yep.
And he wrote that's a lengthy paper, I think it's about 20 pages, about Balkanization. And so what they call for is, like in a country like Syria, or let's take Lebanon. Lebanon has these fractious components, and they govern by consensus. They have a very elaborate formula that the president will always be a Christian from the, you know, the Maronite community, and the prime minister will always be a Sunni, and et cetera, like that. Or a speaker of the house is a Shiite, I think. But it has to have this balance, you see, because they have to get along. And what the Israelis are trying to do is exploit these sectarian differences and to create chaos in the country. And
now, they did that very same thing in Tito's Yugoslavia, did they not?
Well, yes.
They did it in Kosovo, they did it in Herzegovina, they did it in Croatia, they did it. And didn't they do it for some banking causes as well? Because once I look behind the veil of this whole story, in all countries we're talking about today, Iraq, and Serbia and Iran, the three countries that have been targeted violently, you see that these countries didn't have a central bank that was tied to the Zionist Jewish bankers.
Right. And there's usually also there's a strategy. They want to get these countries under their control. Yugoslavia, you know, the former Tito's Yugoslavia was a large socialist country, not tied to the Soviet Union, not tied to Russia, to China, but a socialist economy, a large and very, very well-functioning economy. Yugoslavia, I've been there many times, was a very a prosperous country, even in the dark days of the Soviet Union. It was considered to be the most progressive and advanced of along with Hungary, of these socialist countries, and they had a very good standard of living there, and it was ruined by of course the invasion in the NATO bombing.
And you mentioned that to me in a private call that they've lost about 50% of their GDP, haven't they?
Right. All of the statelets that were broken up, there were like six or seven, ethnic statelets that resulted from the breakup of Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
In all of them, the standard of living has fallen precipitously by about 50%. I was in Belgrade, I was in Zagreb, and areas like that a couple years ago, And it was shocking. It was absolutely shocking to see how bad. And what's happened also is that, you know, criminal gangs have taken over. When the strong central authority from Belgrade disappeared, gangs took over. Now, that's also very important to understand about the creation of the war in Yugoslavia, is that the Serbs were always very forthright about this. They said that there are these Albanian gangs. I think it was called the KLA or something like that. This was a drug smuggling gang of Albanians who they said is behind fomenting the crisis and causing the chaos. And it's interesting that this very same gang took over the red light district of Hamburg in Germany.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, this is not just idle complaints coming from the Serbs. There's a lot of truth in that.
Well, now, and didn't some of the private militias that were there, like DynaCorp and Blackwell Group, didn't the UN and some others get caught bringing some young women into prostitution, even kidnapping some young girls?
Yes, horrible stories of kidnapping young girls, sexual slavery, terrible abuse came out of DynCorp corporations and others, you know, because they send over these contractors, and you know, these people they're not responsible to anybody, and so they have this sense that they can do anything. But
well, now this is important because we've got some of these same characters at play in Iraq right now. Working privately, and we even know that some of the Iraqi women have been turned out in prostitution, and so in other words, this is almost like a repeat here. They're trying to Balkanize that country, which has been the goal from the beginning, and they're even whipping prostitution on an Islamic nation.
Right, and what they're probably also trying to do is push on, you know, smut television and basically try to do everything they can to lower the morale of the population.
Yep.
Just like they've done in Palestine where they try to, you know, they broadcast pornography, Israelis broadcast pornography on these, stations when they occupy a town like Nablus or Ramallah. This is part of their strategy. But about, in Lebanon, we see like in the recent murder of Pierre Jamal, the young Jamal boy, he's something like 34 years old. The Jamal family, you know, the Maronite Christians have always been closely allied with Israel.
Yes, they were Falange, were they not?
Yes, his grandfather was the founder of the Falange. And the Falange, of course, are the guys that provided the foot troops that went into the camps of Sabra and Shatila and killed something like 2,000 Palestinians. You know,
you know what the Falange means, don't you? You know, the little section of your finger is called a Falange.
Isn't it like the tip of a sword or something like that?
Well, no, but the Falange is if your Falange is the area between your first knuckle and the tip of your finger.
Okay.
In French, anyway.
It's like the tip of the spear or something, I think, something like that. It's got some sort of
Now, they were working pretty closely with what's his name, that Cretan that's in a coma there.
They were working with Sharon, very closely with Sharon. Sharon got control of the camps. He went into West Beirut against his own promises and whatnot, against what the Habib and all the Americans had negotiated. The Americans were supposed to be responsible for the safety of the people when the PLO fighters left the country. Remember, they left the country.
Yep.
The United States negotiated that they would go to Tunisia.
Yep.
So all of the men, the PLO men, fighters, got on these boats and went to Tunisia. And then the Israelis surrounded the camps in West Beirut, Sabra and Shatila. And then they provided ground cover, bulldozers, and lighting at night. And they sent in these Falange guys with Israeli helpers. There was Israelis with them. And they massacred something like 2,000 Palestinians. This is one of the greatest massacres in modern history. I mean, this is a cold-blooded massacre. And, of course, Sharon's hands are all over it, but the Israelis basically orchestrated the whole thing. Go ahead.
Yeah.
And then at the time they had one of the Jamal brothers was president. I think it was Bashir or Amin. But Bashir Jamal was killed. And then Amin, the son of Amin, his brother, is Pierre Jamal, the young 34-year-old guy they killed. But the assumption that the Western media takes that this was done by Syria is completely unproven. It's very much like the Hariri murder. They take the most simple approach. Ah, he was an anti-Syrian politician, therefore he must have been killed by Syria.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, that's just like the 9/11. Ah, you know, the planes flew into the World Trade Center, and Michael Chertoff told us that 19 Arabs were flying those planes. Therefore, this must have been done by Arabs.
Well, and it's the same thing as the Levchenko thing. He was going to talk about Russian politics, so it must have been Putin.
Yeah, like you said, he had been to Israel recently.
Yeah.
He worked very closely with Boris Berezovsky, and Boris Berezovsky is, of course, the Jewish Israeli oligarch who, very much wants to get back into Russia because Putin basically disenfranchised all of these Zionists that had taken control of the oil and the mineral assets of Russia, and so they're desperately trying to defame Putin. And so they want to blame this murder on Putin's security forces. But it's like these Mossad killings, which I think they're all Mossad killings, have gone, they're becoming weekly occurrences here. Now, the reason why I think that the murder of the journalist was also an Israeli thing is for the cui bono argument, just like the cui bono argument in the murder of Jamal
or
the murder of Hariri, is who benefits from this? Syria does not benefit by killing the guy that rebuilt Lebanon.
The
president of Lebanon has been on the radio lately. I heard him on the BBC, I think, the other day. His name is Amil Lahoud, and he is a Maronite Christian. He's from the north of Lebanon, and he was on the radio speaking very clearly that he thinks that Israel was behind the murder of both Jamal and Hariri.
Yeah.
We did a
whole show on the Hariri murder, you and I.
Oh yeah. And it's the same sort of thing with this murder of this journalist the Russian journalist in London, because
mm-hmm.
he is a very, very close ally of Boris Berezovsky. Boris Berezovsky is a business partner with Neil Bush, you know, the discredited brother of our president who lost all that money in the Silverado savings and loan crisis or debacle. And when I was over in Latvia and Estonia about a year ago, Boris Berezovsky and Neil Bush were sharing the podium and talking about what wonderful business partners they are. They have, you know, all kinds of pokers in the fire, but all kinds of businesses that they work together at. And I think that the American people should really understand that the Bush family works very closely with these criminal Zionist oligarchs from Russia.
Yeah. And we've often talked about on this program and with you that there's a strong connection between the Ashkenazi sect and the Russian mafia being Jewish and Zionist, and what's going on in Israel being under these same people. These Likudniks are by and large controlled by a large element within that Russian Jewish mafia construct. Am I wrong?
Yeah, and that's right. And the thing is that the state of Israel today is under a very, very bad government, and it's because their government is tainted by organized crime in the same way that our government is. I don't pull any punches on this, and my logical conclusion after studying U.S. elections and how fraudulent they are and the people that, you know, populate the U.S. government is that we have a crimeocracy. We have a government in which criminals and perverts and psychopaths get advanced because of their criminal background or because of their perversion.
That
needs to be understood. That's why we have these unanimous votes, for war in Iraq. I mean, it's an illegal war in Iraq, but that's why Congress will give a rubber stamp and give the president, $2 billion a week to fight illegal wars, you know, when the American people don't have a railroad worth beans and there's plenty of want in this country.
Well, what's your answer, Christopher, to the people who say it's the Luciferian criminals, it's the New World Order? Eric and I have put out so many times, this is a smokescreen. I mean, let's call these people who they are. They're criminal Zionist Jews running the show.
Right, and the thing is that that they run the show, but they've done this for so long, they're very good at it, and what they do is that they are always behind the scene, like any play, and they are controlling the actors, And you don't see them because they're behind the scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're the financiers of the, you know, they created the Bank of England, and they're the financiers of the crown. They're the financiers of the U.S. government. They're the financiers. And the more that the U.S. government, for example, in this war in Iraq, the more the United States government becomes indebted, the more it has to listen to these people. So the United States and Britain are probably the most controlled nations, you know, to this Zionist financial elite.
Yeah.
The state of Israel is in a bad way, too. You know, they have this Ehud Olmert, who's not only a Jabotinsky Zionist from the most extreme, you know, revisionist Zionism, but he was implicated in criminal actions and criminal behavior in the state of Israel. And the only reason he wasn't, you know, convicted is because a judge decided that they wouldn't prosecute him. Just like they decided recently, I think with Spitzer, that fellow in New York, the prosecutor, decided that they would not prosecute Maurice Greenberg. They had a whole raft of offenses by Maurice Greenberg, you know, the international group.
And isn't he right now trying to negotiate for the purchase of
the New York Times?
New York Times.
Yeah, and he was considered as one of the guys who could take over the Chicago Tribune as well. But he's trying to buy into the media. He wants to buy. He's trying to buy up all the loose stock from the New York Times. He's trying to make a hostile takeover of the New York Times. And Maurice Greenberg is in this criminal. Enterprise, and there's a lot of very, very wealthy Zionists in the United States who have played a great role in what I call the cover up of 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, for example, there's a family in Cleveland, Ohio, the Ratner family.
Yeah.
Now, the Ratners pop up everywhere you look in the 9/11 conspiracy. There was a Ratner who sold the steel to China on the fast boat to China.
Yeah,
there was before it could be, you know, really investigated. There was a Ratner who made the film about the attack on the Pentagon. There was a Ratner who ran. There was a Ratner employee married to the Ratner. His name is Mr. Miller, Sam Miller. He runs Four City Enterprises in Cleveland. He used to run. He ran the mayor of Cleveland. Now that's what I'm getting at. He ran the mayor of Cleveland once a week, or is it twice a week? The Cleveland Plain Dealer wrote. He would meet with the mayor of Cleveland. It's a black man named White, Mayor White. And he
the man that wouldn't speak to you about this.
Yeah, he wouldn't speak to me. He's now raising alpacas in central Ohio.
Yeah.
I called him up. He said he's no longer in the business doing interviews. But this guy is very key because some very weird things happened in Cleveland on 9/11, particularly the landing of two planes, one which was identified as Flight 93. You know,
well, how does Frank Lowy get involved in this with Silverstein?
Right.
And what's the louder connection to Ratner and the rest?
Right. Well, the one of the key organizations that these men have in common is called the United Jewish Appeal.
Yeah.
The UJA. And Sam Miller was a national chairman of the UJA, as was Larry Silverstein was a national chairman of the same organization. Frank Lowy is a big shooter in the UJA. You know, these guys all... If you look at the events of UJA, United Jewish Appeal, or these Zionist fundraisers that they have time to time in New York City, where have you, you will see photographs of like Larry Silverstein and Rupert Murdoch and Frank Lowy, all, you know, having a good time as they raise money for Israel.
Do you see connections to the Newhouse family in this mess?
The Newhouse family, I'm sure, is right in there because they're Zionist Jews. But I haven't looked at the Newhouse family lately. I don't know what their connection is to UJA. But that's the, what I'm getting at is that these people, this criminal enterprise, this what I say about the state of Israel is that it's being run by a criminal gang. The Zionists that control the state of Israel today and have controlled for a long time are basically a large international criminal network.
The mafia.
They are.
Yeah,
they are.
Jewish mafia, and now they're pressing their wares into the Lebanese theater, but let's go into Iraq for a second and talk about how they've been successful at the Balkanization of that country, unbeknownst to the American public, because the American public thinks that somehow things have gone terribly wrong in Iraq, but it seems to me they're getting exactly what they wanted there.
Well, they haven't gotten exactly what they wanted yet. They haven't got Iraqis killing each other. That's what they really want. They want the Shiite militias to be fighting the Sunnis in the streets of Fallujah and Basra and Bakuba. And they want Iraqis to be killing each other. That's, of course, the most efficient thing for them. That's why they enjoyed so much this decade-long war between Iran and Iraq. What the Zionists always want to do is they want to get the goys to kill the goys. They want us to kill each other.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's for them the real harvest when they have something like World War I or World War II. And you know, Europeans are killing each other and Arabs are killing each other. And that's what they really want, but they haven't been able to get that. That's why they have to do every day. They have to do these incredible bombings. You know, like yesterday there were 3 car bombs that went off. Now, anybody with any common sense, whether they're American or French or Arab, should ask themselves, now why would somebody put off 3 very carefully planned, you know, very precisely done car bombings in Bakuba, wherever it was, and not take responsibility for it?
Yeah.
Why would Sunnis or Shiites or anybody else, why would they attack a marketplace, for example, you know, a random target? If these Sunnis or Shiites or whoever it is really wanted to attack the enemy, why wouldn't they attack the enemy's leaders? Why wouldn't they take out, you know, one of the sheikhs, you know?
Or Maqtada al-Sadr.
Yeah, a good example. Why wouldn't they go after the head of the movement that they're opposed to? Because you have to understand, this is only meant for public consumption. This is meant to give the impression to the world that the Iraqis are killing each other, that they can't live together, and that they have to be broken up into statelets, because that's what they really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the Iraqis, you know, most Iraqis you talk to, have no intention of separating their country. They want to be They very much want to live as Iraqis. The only ones who are really of a separatist mind are the Kurds, because the Kurds have been they are a different ethnic group, and also because they want to, you know, create Kurdistan. They want their own you know, greater state. There's something like 20 million Kurds, and they want to have their own country.
That's right. Well,
go ahead.
No, but see, we see that they're. They are moving toward a successful Balkanization and civil strife and civil war, and of course the American press is pushing that as the unavoidable end game here in Iraq, and they're making it look like, well, America has thoroughly been defeated there, when in fact it looks like to me that since the goal has been that, they've been quite successful. Now, how do they get this started in Lebanon now? Of course, Hezbollah. They said Hezbollah won against the Israeli army. And I thought to myself, how can you consider one if you've got $1.5 billion dollars worth of damage of homes, 1,000 people dead, tens of thousands homeless, and just rack and ruin everywhere, and all the Israelis have lost is maybe 70 people.
Right.
How could that possibly be construed as a victory?
No, it's not a victory in that sense. Of course, the Israelis devastated the country of Lebanon. As you said, they bombed it from the far north to the far south, from east to west. They did an incredible amount of damage. And of course, the Israeli attack on Lebanon was aggression. And that's what Yamil Lahoud, the president, says. I mean, that it was, you know, the Israelis, he says, you know, how can you blame the Syrians? Just look back a couple months ago and look who it was who was destroying Lebanon then.
Yeah.
You know, the Syrians have no interest in destroying Lebanon. You know, Lebanon has always been, you know, part of Syria. It basically is and was part of Syria, greater Syria. But since, you know, First World War, when they created the independent Lebanon, you know, but Lebanon and Syria are brother nations in the real sense of the word. Why would the Syrians, you know, destroy Lebanon? No, it's a Mossad operation to destabilize Lebanon, to try and foment another civil war like they had in the 70s, in order to try and, you know, balkanize that country into minor statelets. Because, you see, if they do that, then of course, they will be able to probably control the southern part of Lebanon, which is what they really want. The Israelis really, really want to control northern Lebanon up to the Litani River, because they need that water. They need that good soil. They need that water. And so they really want to get, they covet the southern part of Lebanon. And, you know, to depopulate, southern Lebanon for them is no big deal. They do it like every 5 years. They just send flyers and said, get out of South Lebanon or we'll kill you. Yeah. If you don't get out of there, you get cluster bombed.
Well, and so that's what has happened there. So now we've got two environments being completely, destroyed by, and in some cases by American boys and bombs and money. But we've got behind the scenes, the orchestrators of this are clearly, these Zionist Jews. Now, how is Syria getting drawn into this, and what's their end game for Syria?
Same thing. I just wanted to point out, you know, we've heard about the cluster bombs in South Lebanon. Mm-hmm. We've seen the immense amount of damage, the huge war crimes. And what do we read about in our picture in the United States? We read about Darfur.
Yeah.
The genocide of Darfur. And if you look at who's behind the Darfur campaign, these organizations, they're Jews.
Yeah.
It's American Jews who are running this Darfur propaganda campaign. Because, you see, when there's a raging fire or there's a terrible criminal crime, a terrible thing done, like in the case of Lebanon, they don't want you to look at Lebanon. Let's shine a light over here on Darfur, you know, this place where nobody's ever been. And then look at this terrible atrocity here. Look at this burned down hut here.
And they were financing the Janjaweed militiamen that were coming in to Darfur to do the ethnic cleansing.
Were they really?
Of course
yeah.
they were.
Yeah.
I did a little investigation on this Janjaweed and where they were yeah. getting their money, and it came from some warlords, and they needed to depopulate that area because they've actually found some oil in that area.
Oh yes, there's a lot of oil there. And there's, you know, our friend Carl Bildt, the former prime minister of Sweden, there's the Lundin, there's all kinds of big oil companies that have staked out claims in that western part of Sudan, because it's got a lot of oil there.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing like we said what they did in Yugoslavia. They covet the assets of a certain place and create havoc there and go in and grab the assets and keep the people fighting each other and say, look at these people, they can't get along. These Sudanese, they can't get along. These Yugoslavians, they can't get along, or Iraqis. And if you look behind the scene, you always find, you know, and one question about Iraq. Why is it that all of these bombings, like the recent bombing, nobody claims responsibility? Now that's the first question. Why would somebody go to the trouble of planting car bombs and blowing up, you know, 100 people, 50 people, and not say, you know, a bona fide group say, we did this for this reason? This is one of the hallmarks, if they talk about hallmarks, of false flag terror. That no real entity takes responsibility, and then nobody ever gets caught. How can it be that there are scores of people killed in Iraq every single day in this American, Anglo-American, Zionist-controlled country, where we have something like 150,000 American troops, where we monitor the borders, you know, more closely than we do our own, and they never catch any of these terrorists? How can that be?
Well, actually, they have actually stopped some people and discovered that their car was laden with bombs, and they were two British SAS men.
And that's right. That was last year.
And they chased him into a police station, didn't they?
When the Iraqi police are allowed to do their own work, they catch these guys. And when, like you said, when they caught those two guys down there in Basra, and they took off their disguises, they turned out to be British secret agents.
Yep.
And like you said, their car was full of explosives. They were full of detonators. They had just driven by a protest of Shiites, and they had shot at the protest and the police. And of course, they were being held on terrorism charges. And the British said, release them now. They sent a high-level diplomatic mission to try and get them freed. When that failed, they sent in the tanks. And the tanks knocked down the wall of the prison. They got the head of the prison, the Iraqi head of the prison. They put a gun to his head, and they said, you let those two British guys go, or you're dead. So, of course, they were set free. But, I mean, if they were prosecuted, it would have exposed the false flag terror. A lot of people said that when they shot at that car of the Italian journalist, that was why they did it, because she had evidence that the false flag terrorism in Iraq was indeed, you know, fake.
And she's not talking, is she?
No. Her bodyguard was killed. The secret agent, the secret Italian agent
right.
guy was killed.
But so she just filtered back into her home society and shut her mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, but you see, yesterday, all of the Italians have now left Iraq. There's no more Italian troops in Iraq. And that's important because Italy was the third nation in the coalition. You know, it was the United States, Britain, and Italy. Now every Italian has left. They've got a few Estonians left over there, maybe a couple Latvians, but otherwise it's, you know, and I really feel sorry for this American population, the American people and the British people who send their sons and daughters to these illegal wars without really much of a protest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a guy here in Chicago who protested the war, and Malachi, I forgot his last name, but about a month ago, he self-immolated himself. And it wasn't very much broadcast in the news. He sat down on a bridge, wrapped himself in an American flag, and burned himself alive. And the police are withholding the video of this because for investigation. But this has been very much downplayed. But, you know, there are people of conscience in this country, but they really want to keep the protest against the war, you know, at a very low profile.
Well, but see, I'm starting to see some other cracks in the veneer here, Chris, and you may not be as up on these subjects as I am, but that the finances of the country are taking an awful hit right now. There are a lot of countries running for the exits when it comes to the dollar, and of course, you and I both know. The only reason the dollar is used at all in this world is because it controls so much oil, and they price their oil in dollars. If the petrol dollar didn't have its footing in oil, it would disappear in a week.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
and I'm wondering, you know, I can't see that this Ponzi scheme is going to continue much longer, and I also see the American public starting to really. They're starting to become angry, and we're talking 70-80% of the public now know 9/11 was an inside job. They may not be completely convinced of all the facts around it, but they certainly know whatever they were told was a lie. Now they're starting to also understand that the Israelis are behind most of our problems.
Yeah.
You can see that in the reporting.
Yeah,
I'm wondering when's the flashpoint? When are we going to just say that's enough now? And start really taking this stuff to the streets.
Yeah, I don't know. You see, the Israelis have this airtight control of the media in this country, and that's the greatest problem because, you know, in the 60s, for example, when we had our protests against the war in Vietnam, we had more accurate, better reporting from Vietnam. We understood the cost of the war in terms of, you know, casualties and also we had an active anti-war movement in terms of singing and protests. And because that doesn't exist anymore, because they've got this, you know, they control the media, and there is no anti-war movement in the media anymore. Why is it that so few Hollywood people or singers crusade against these illegal wars? That's the thing. And the American people, by and large, with the exception of people like Malachi or people like you and me, will not take an unpopular position. You know, still
it's every man for himself mentality, Chris.
Yes, and Americans are much poorer than they were in the 60s. In the 60s,
yeah.
Americans had, like I say, Americans were still cool because they had some sense of security. Financial security and they were secure in who they were. More secure. They people were more wealthy. Today, Americans are so indebted and so, broken that, they're not going to go out and stick out their neck because if they do, they'll get fired like me, you know?
Yeah.
They live from paycheck to paycheck. And when you lose your job, I mean, I work for this populist newspaper. I did work for this populist paper called American Free Press. It's a one-man operation. There's nothing populist about it. The whole time I worked there, I didn't get any benefits whatsoever, dental benefits, medical benefits, nothing.
Yeah.
And they kept cutting my salary. So that I was paid less when I finished working for that paper than I did when I started.
Yeah.
But then, you see, they said that I was disloyal. I had said something, you know, I had not defended them against Eric Hochschmidt's questionings about the paper, and they fired me like that in one day. In one day.
Well, haven't they refused to release all the money that was sent there on your behalf?
They collected a massive amount of money. We know they collected a great deal of money from my legal defense fund. Mr. Cardo, Willis Cardo, who is the publisher of the paper. He told me the day after it happened, he said, you got a $1 million case here. You know, we'll get Mark Lane on this and whatnot, and we'll sue those police, and it'll be a $1 million case. And he said, we'll start raising a legal defense fund for you. I said, okay, that's fine. And they did that for like 2 months, and they fired me, and now they're withholding it.
Yeah.
They said that they told me in a letter they sent me, I think it was, they said that they have returned the money that came after September 13th or something. I mean, it's pure rubbish. They didn't return the money. You know, a lot of people have written and asked, well, you know, where's my money gone? They think it's really bad that the paper, but you know, it's also illegal. My understanding is it's illegal to collect money, to say you're collecting money for, say, example, Christopher Boland's legal defense fund, and then pocket it and put it into Ricardo's pocket or put it into a Swiss bank account. That's illegal. But I would have to, of course, go through the process of suing American Free Press, to find out where that money's gone. And it's a newspaper that has never been transparent. And so I don't know.
Well, what's this relationship between Piper and this Cassiopeian Cretan Laura Knight Janik or whatever her name
is? Laura Knight Janik. I don't know.
She's a Jewish gal who has been involved in stealing and embezzling money in America. Had to leave the country. Leave Florida, I believe, and
yes.
She's now here running around the French countryside as a wanted American criminal, and Piper's in thick as thieves with this Cretan, and so is the Wing TV people, and so are people like John Kaminsky, and I mean, all it's almost like a huge stink comes out of these people. And what's the story that you can see with these folks?
That's very bizarre. That's very bizarre. You know, some people point to this, it's a Masonic thing. I don't know. But this Laura Knight Janik, she has that Signs of the Times website, blog. It's very bizarre. You know, they have something like 50 pages in which they've attacked me. And I just can't understand for the life of me why they're so preoccupied with what Mr. Boleyn says and does.
Well, now they're saying that I'm half alien, and that's why I have no soul because I'm an alien.
You
and
too,
all
huh? You too. Yeah. They say I'm an organic portal, and I don't have a soul. I guess an organic portal. I don't know what that means. It's just organic stuff, organic in, organic out, but nothing in the middle. I don't know. It's very weird.
Christopher, when I read that, and you said they said you were the same thing, I said, well, they got one thing right. We are similar. You and I are both fighting for the truth. But as far as being an organic portal, I you know, what in the heck? And see, the problem is that the Piper still is getting some audience. Shame on those people for that.
I can't understand that because, you know, Piper is very, very strange. He's never been a friend of mine, and that needs to be understood. I thought his book on the Kennedy murder was good. I promoted it in my library. But he tries to portray himself as being a friend of mine. He's never done anything to help me. In fact, I do know that my stocks, my supposed ownership of American Free Press, my stocks in the company disappeared while they were on his desk. So I don't know what he's given me, but I certainly know some of the things that he's taken from me.
Yeah.
And he's been very, very, mean to me and my family. He after I was attacked by the police, he started attacking me and he actually told Willis Cardo that if I were to come to the conference in Washington, that he would not. He would boycott that conference. And at that time, of course, he was very close to the Wing TV people. He still is.
Yeah.
But these people all seem to be, they have some sort of like satanic or some perversion going on there. I know that he is not a straight person, that he has gay relationships with, you know, a black guy and a Jewish fellow and whatnot. But I mean, I never held his gayness as anything, you know, I never thought it was anything that I should be concerned is not my problem.
Yeah.
But now I see, you know, now I see that it became my problem. I mean, that he does have this, his morals are compromised. I don't know.
But see, here's the interesting thing. When you look at the lineup at RBN, you've got this Abramson, you've got this Bermas. It's Jewish Central over there.
Oh, is Jason Bermas has a show there now?
Oh, yeah.
Boy.
You go down the list of people, and of course, we're fighting World Zionism, and they load up their roster with Jews. And excuse me, not all Jews are involved in this. You know that as well as I do, Christopher. There's a lot of good Jews out there fighting for the truth, and I got to give them their due here.
You know what they do. You know what they do when they're in that position. It's the same thing when I was at the University of California in Santa Cruz. I told you I started an anti-war movement. I had a Palestine support group type thing, and we were talking about the causation of the war, what was pushing the war, and these young Jewish kids took over the anti-war movement. They pushed me out. as they are wont to do, and they do that for one reason. That is to protect Israel. That is to protect Israel. It's the same thing in the 9/11 movement. When you have these Jewish guys coming into the 9/11 movement, their one goal, they can point the finger here. They'll point the finger at the Luciferians, at the Jewish death cult, at Bush and Cheney in particular. They'll point it everywhere, except at Israel.
That's right.
You know, and when the evidence points at Israel, they'll do some sort of spin on it and say, oh, well, you know, the Israelis were just there to monitor and to warn the Americans. Well, if the Israelis were there to warn the Americans, how come those guys at Odigo didn't pick up the phone and call, you know, the mayor of New York and the police chief and say, look, you guys have a real serious bomb scare at the World Trade Center this morning?
Have you seen this recent report from Muckraker?
I saw a little bit about it. I saw something about Muckraker last night. What was that?
Well, it talks about an Israeli having overheard the actual putting together of the plot and tried desperately in advance of quite a time in advance, 6 or 8 months in advance.
Yeah.
So according to this article, there are several requests that were made to the FBI trying to get them to take seriously what he had found out. And
right.
Of course, now if
you
I can't get a confirmation on it, Eric.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Christopher. I can't get a confirmation on it. Is my point.
I know. I think I tried to call him a few weeks ago. This is the guy that overheard in the Jewish cemetery. He spoke Hebrew, and he overheard these guys speaking Hebrew, talking about, you know, well, we're going to teach them something about terrorism, and the two towers, the twins will come down, and all that. Well, I mean, you know, whether or not we prove what that guy's, you know, we have, like, Eric Hirschman, I think, has on his website, and I showed in my recent veteran thing about 9/11, I showed the footage from the Israeli television show where three of those very sheepish-looking guys from Israel were on in Israel, in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, probably Tel Aviv, talking. And the one guy said, I forgot his name, but Elad something, he said very clearly, we were there to document the event.
Yeah.
Well, hello. You know, it doesn't get very much closer to an admission of guilt when you say, we were there to document the event. Well, and we know that they were working with Mossad. These were three of the movers who were caught in New Jersey that afternoon with multiple passports, with box cutters, with a van that tested positive for explosives until the FBI got its hands on it. And these guys were videotaping and celebrating the collapse and the attacks on the World Trade Center, dressed with some keffiyehs or in some way to look like Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, when they were caught by the New Jersey sergeant, the New Jersey police, according to William Rodriguez, he told me that the New Jersey sergeant was told when they discovered that these were Israelis, said, you don't mention a word that they were Israelis to anybody. And what we know that they turned out to be working for a Mossad front. So you have Israeli intelligence agents who obviously have prior knowledge, photographing, videotaping the attacks on the World Trade Center, going back to Israel and speaking in clear Hebrew that they were there to document the event because America's never had terror like the Israelis have on a day-to-day basis. And that's another thing. A lot of the terror in Israel is also false flag terror.
Of course it is. And you'll often notice that it hits in areas of Israel where you'll get some of the minority Israelis that are in out of favor anyway.
Exactly. And it not only that, because, of course, the Israelis have had a large immigration from Russia. A lot of non-Jews have come in, and they really don't like this. You know, like they have these laws in Israel that, you know, that if you're not racially pure as a Jew for 10 generations, you're persona non grata. And what they do is they have these spectacular terror attacks that occur precisely at the day when, for example, the U.S. Secretary of State is staying across the street in a hotel. And he'll look out his window in the morning and he'll see, oh, a terror bomb went up across the street. And like you said, at the disco or something, it was a terror bomb that night, and 19 Russian kids were killed. None of them were Jews, for example.
Yeah.
And I remember there was that happened, and none of those kids could be buried in the Jewish cemetery because they weren't Jewish. It's exactly like you say. And there was a bombing a couple years ago in downtown Jerusalem, and all the early reports said a car bomb went off. Car bomb went off, and then yet when they towed the car away, a tow truck came and towed the car away. Then it became a suicide bomber. Exactly what they're doing. Exactly what they're doing in Iraq.
Yep.
These are not, 9 times out of 10, these are not suicide bombers in any sense of the word. These are just, you know, false flag operations in which a car bomb has been placed someplace and then detonated remotely. And who's providing a security for the Iraqi people? The Americans, the British, the Israelis, and their Quislings.
I heard, you know, that there are as many as 60,000 private contractor types running around that country.
Yes. Where do you think the $2 billion goes every week?
That's right.
I mean, you know, they're not rebuilding the country. You know, they have done nothing to improve the standard of living for the Iraqis. The standard of living for Iraqis has fallen. Like I said, forget about 50%. It's fallen like 90%.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, and now they're going to, like you said, they're going to pass this off as a, they're saying that Iraq is a failed state now. It wasn't a failed state before you attacked it.
That's right.
And I mean, this is where we, you know, people can't let Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld off the hook so easily. I mean, these people committed a terrible war crime and are responsible for the deaths of over a million people.
Well, you know, here's where it gets dicey. Mm-hmm. You take a look at the acquiescence of the European governments here. You know, the French and the Spanish and Germans and the rest of it, they know what's going on. They know this full story. Mm-hmm. And they're in complete alliance with, at least by staying silent on all these facts. Now, and so is Putin. He's not talking. He's not telling the truth. Well, yeah. Who's finally gonna come out as a government and say, look, this is what the Americans did. Our intelligence service knows the story. When will that happen?
Yeah. Well, I that's the thing. I don't know when that'll happen, but you know, when you look at something like Afghanistan or even Iraq, what you may be seeing a struggle between Russia and the United States, you know, playing itself out in a third place like Afghanistan was before. You know,
so you think Putin might be a Bonapartist, might have gone off the reservation on these people.
I think that Putin might, I mean, the Russians, for example, might very well be, you know, working with, in the Afghan struggle. I mean, we know that the Americans and the British are supporting the Chechens, you know, in their struggle against the Russians. And so, you know, for the Russians to be, you know, fighting against the Americans or having support for their enemies in Afghanistan wouldn't be unheard of. I mean, look at
the isn't the American government behind the Shevardnadze and the Georgian the dispute too?
Very much so. Very much so. The president of Georgia today, the pro-Western president of Georgia today, is American educated and he's completely in cahoots with the American government. And now, you know, Georgia is on the verge of a war.
That's right.
It's very dicey. And it's, you know, the United States, it's the same thing what the United States has done in all of these countries. You see, what they've done is that they get control of a place like Estonia or Latvia or Georgia or what have you. And then they start bringing the defense officials from these countries to the Marshall Center in Germany, in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, where they're trained and they're made agents of the U.S. government. And in the case of like of Estonia, a very small country, 1 million people, when I was in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, there were more than 100 Estonians from the Defense Department had been trained as American agents at the Marshall Center. And the same thing with Georgia.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then they create these
pro-Western agents that are supposed to do their bidding, but they're next door neighbors to Russia. And it causes conflict. This causes conflict. This puts these countries, you know, in a position of conflict with their big neighbor on whom they rely for energy resources. So it doesn't do them any good. It doesn't do them any good to be lackeys of the West when the West is so, you know, across the ocean.
Now, let's talk about this guy Feldman, this ambassador to Lebanon here. Now, I may stand corrected, but he must, you know, based upon name recognition here, he sounds Jewish.
Yeah.
Now, he may not be, but, you know, maybe someone out there can clarify fact.
But look at his background. He's born in 1959, I think, in Greenville, Ohio. His father's David, his mother's Roberta. But he came to the Foreign Service in 1986, and his first mission was for 2 years to Haiti. Then he went to Hungary. Then he became the U.S. official for special assistant to the Deputy Assistant Secretary on aid to Eastern Europe in 1991, 1993. So he was involved in the Payola schemes in the newly liberated countries of Eastern Europe. 1991 is when Eastern Europe was liberated. So you have these little countries like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, who are between a rock and a hard place. You know, they're desperately in need of aid. And so then this guy comes in, the U.S. Secretary of State comes in and gives them a little bit of money. And if you go along, you'll get more money. So they get them on the payola scheme. Then he went in 1995, he became economic officer in Tel Aviv, Israel, where he served for 3 years. Then he went to Tunisia for 2 years. Then he went back to Israel for 2000 and 2001, and he was the special assistant to the ambassador on the peace process. Then he became the U.S. Deputy Chief of Mission in Jerusalem in 2001, 2002. Then he became the acting principal officer in Jerusalem at the consulate from 2002, 2003. Then he went from there, he went to Iraq, and he was in Kurdistan, in Erbil, in 2004 until April 2004. And then from there, he went straight to Lebanon. And this guy, if he's not a Zionist Jew, he certainly has he's won the confidence of the Israelis very well. He served in Israel for the better part of 7-8 years.
You ever heard of a guy named Latos here from California that they're trying to put into that special position there?
Tom Lantos, Hungarian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy, but did that turn my stomach, Chris? I mean, this guy is a hardcore Israel supporter.
Right, right. And look at him. Look at Emmanuel, Rahm Emanuel.
Oh yeah.
That's what I'm saying is that these Rahm Emanuel is like the number three guy in the Democratic Party. But more important than that, he is the chief power broker. He is the one who is the head of the caucus, and he's the one who decides, you know, whether Tammy Duckworth wins or this fellow wins, or whether Murtha will be the assistant speaker of the House or this person will be. He's the broker. He's the deal maker. He's the guy that twists arms and cajoles people and gets the result that they want. I mean, he's the guy who pushed NAFTA through for Bill Clinton. He was in Clinton's administration. He was the head of political issues and strategy. He had an office right next to the Oval Office. His desk was right up against the door of the Oval Office. He's the arm twister. And he's very good at arm twisting because his father was an Irgun terrorist in Palestine. So he learned how to twist arms and break arms push the envelope at an early age.
Well, the intrigue here,
Israeli American controls the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
What's wrong with these people?
Well, and you know they just jump all. They're all jumping ship off the Republicans because they've used that one up, and now they're going to go back into the Democrat Party and suck the life out of that.
But doesn't quite work like that. You see, that's the thing. They don't have to jump ship. They are resident in both parties all the time. You know, like Lou Eisenberg, the guy that was in charge of the World Trade Center property prior to 2001, Lou Eisenberg, the guy that was involved in the transaction where that property wound up in the hands of Larry Silverstein. That guy is the head of finances for the Republican National Committee, RNC, I think it's called. He's the guy that controls the money for the Republican Party. Now, he's not going to go and suddenly become a Democrat. He stays there. So it's like both parties are completely controlled by Zionists.
Well, where are we going? What do you see on the immediate horizon? I'm seeing financial pressures starting to really exert themselves in America, and I'm seeing a huge precipitous slide in the dollar's value, and I'm seeing a lot of countries running for exits when it comes to their reserves, dollar reserve in their currency holdings.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also starting to see a lot more problems. In other words, it looks like America's next reports about their economy and their unemployment figures are going to really start showing up to be some terrible stuff. And I see a serious slide in the next 3 months.
Oh, you're absolutely right about that. We're living in America 1928.
Yeah.
You know, we're living in the times of where all the credit has been spent, where everybody is in hock and in debt over their head. The Roaring Twenties are over. We've waged these two illegal wars. They've been disastrous. The national treasury is bankrupt. The gangsterism of the 20s has is going to wake up to a real hangover. And like you say, you know, there's people are fleeing the dollar. The dollar is now worth, one euro is $1.32 or something like that.
$1.33.50 now.
Yeah, it's something like $2 per pound in Britain, sterling. Yeah, the dollar is deflating. Everything's not going very well.
Well, it's like the wheels are coming off, and I'm wondering,
right?
What happens when the wheels come off? Except that people start becoming angry and protesting, because I mean, what'll get an American involved and away from his television set, possibly,
yeah,
is when they start losing their jobs.
Well, it'll be a real problem when they can no longer afford their antidepressants. when they can't afford their Prozac, then we're going to have a real problem, because we're going to have 10 million crazy people running around this country. No, I mean, they've got it all primed. This is primed. This country's primed for, like you say, a meltdown. You know, I'm not a doomsayer, but I really don't see very much, particularly because we've had 10, 15 years of criminal leadership, real criminal leadership. The Clinton administration, this Bush administration, you know, the 9/11. I don't understand how this government could stay in power, but it's only because it's like, I call it a nation on Prozac. It's a nation that is disconnected from reality. And
yeah,
that disconnect is largely attributable to television.
Yeah.
If Americans went to the library, if Americans read more and watch TV less, you know, we'd have a much more alert nation. But unfortunately, you know, we have a nation that's living in la-la land.
What do you think Ahmadinejad's response is going to be in this? I mean, you think he's just going to be a broker from behind the scenes? Or because I know elements within Iran are behind these people, that are actually mm-hmm. working with the Israelis. There are parts of it. I mean, I don't think Ahmadinejad is behind working with the Israelis. I may be wrong.
Yeah.
I don't think he is. But I know there are very powerful elements in Israel that have had in Iran, have worked with Israelis. If you go all the way back to the Iran-Contra, it was an Israeli middleman and working with Adnan Khashoggi that was funneling a lot of that stuff into Iran back in the 80s. So, I mean,
right,
these guys have a long history and a long-term working relationship. Of course, you know, and they fomented that war between Saddam and they knew that was going on at the time. So I'm wondering how much of this is smoke and how much of it's real.
Well, that's a very good question. You know, the thing is that like you know that many Israelis, I think the Israeli chief of staff and whatnot, are born in Iran or born in Iraq. I think it was Shaul Mofaz. He's born in Iran, I believe. Many of them. There's a large Iranian population in Israel. And, but I don't think that I've read Ahmadinejad's letter to the American people. I think that he's genuine. But as you say, the Israelis certainly have their people in place in Iran. You know, the Israelis, for a small country like they are of a couple million people, they have the most aggressive, intelligence service in the world.
Yeah. I know.
And the audacity, you know, you know, what we see with the Israeli involvement in 9/11, it's audacious, but they only would do such a thing like that if they knew that they would control the investigation that would follow in the United States. And because they have Michael Chertoff, their Israeli point man, you know, as assistant attorney general, they knew that they could control the investigation. But they also control the disposal of the metal. They control the mayor of New York. They control the mayor of Cleveland. They control a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you, myself, Eric. There's not a lot of us out there that are actually really telling these facts. Who else out there do you have a modicum or a solid belief in that they're genuine? I mean, I have trouble finding people that I trust.
That's what you said is very true. I mean, you know, with my 9/11 research, I don't know any, because I've been on speaking tours with Eric Hushmid. Eric Hushmid's work and his book is the best on the subject, simply because it puts the photographic evidence into the hands of the reader. That's what I think is the most important thing. But I've been on speaking tours with other 9/11 writers and things like that, and, you know, most of them aren't doing any research at all.
Yeah.
Most of them don't call the Ratners, they don't call the Simons, they don't call here, they don't do any actual digging on their own. They're compilers. They compile what other people have done. Now, that doesn't take us anywhere. We need real research. And the thing is, what I've learned is that real research gets you into trouble. I mean, I got tasered, my arm was broken, and now I'm unemployed. And I have to struggle, you know, I have to push my children's book, I have to do other work to make ends meet. I have seen, unfortunately, but historically, it has to be said, there is no money in promoting the truth in this country today. We are living in such an occupied time where lies prevail that if you're out there looking for the truth or speaking the truth, you know, you're like a prophet in his own country. They don't want to hear you. They don't want to hear you. You know, and you know, the papers in Chicago, when I have 9/11 events, when I present evidence of thermite, when I brought William Rodriguez here, when I give the evidence of 9/11 that it's a hoax or that the towers were demolished, not a single media outlet came. They're not interested in this.
No.
They prefer, and that's why I call this country has become a kingdom of lies. And it's a kingdom because it's not a democracy. It's a kingdom. We're living under a dictatorship. This is a de facto dictatorship. And that sounds like people might think, well, this guy's really crazy. But I ask them, if they're Americans, when was the last time they saw a single vote being counted?
That's right.
And if you have elections in which you can't count the votes, what good is your democratic franchise?
Well, you know, Christopher, I got to be honest with you. I mean, in my little village area around here in France, the people don't want to know the truth either. They don't want it. And in fact, when I brought up the subject, I've been called a nutter. They think I'm needing Prozac. And I stopped sharing information with them because, I found out that I was getting the ire and the anger of my fellows and not their support.
Mm-hmm. But I have seen that there's a great deal more support for your position in Europe than there is here. I mean, in terms of Europeans understand that the war in Iraq is illegal. The French foreign ministry was very clear about this. They wouldn't call it aggression, but they, you know, Chirac and the French foreign ministry said that if the United States and Britain go into war in Iraq, if they aggress Iraq without getting a second resolution from the United Nations, then that would be illegal. The war would be illegal, they said.
Yeah.
And that's the situation we're in right now. And I mean, the French, at least they know the law. But for Americans don't even understand the concept. Very few Americans understand the concept of an illegal war.
Huh.
They think that, you know, because American people have been traumatized by so many wars, you know, this country goes to war more often than even Israel does. We have squabbles, which are wars. We invade Grenada, you know, or Panama. It might be a week adventure, or it might be a 2 week adventure, or it might be a 3 day adventure. But it's a war for Panama. It's a war for the people in Grenada, and it's a regime change. It's an overthrow, it's an occupation, and yet our country, we have become, you know, we have turned from being a democratic republic, an advanced progressive country, in the last 100. Because we've become a downtrodden, warmongering nation where the people are deceived.
And I can tell you right now that we're not.
That's where the coolness went. Go ahead.
Well, Christopher, you've been to Europe in the recent year and a half. You know that we're becoming disliked as a nation. I mean, and as a people. I try to keep it a little bit under wraps that I'm an American even because
mm-hmm.
we're not liked. And
no.
It's actually becoming a little dangerous to be an American.
Oh yes. I remember being in Cyprus in the 70s and you know, being attacked because I was American, you know, because Henry Kissinger had tricked the Cypriot people to killing other Cypriots in that disastrous war that's still bothering us today. You know, that's the thing is that the United States, that's the thing about populism that I thought American Free Press, you know, stood for, is that American interventionism is unnecessary and unwarranted. The United States should mind its own business and keep itself at home. But what's happened in this country is that our Constitution has been changed over time, created a czar. The president is now a king. And that, who does that behoove? That behooves people that can control that person. And so that Congress, our representative body, has become very, very weak. And you can contrast this with Switzerland, which has basically the same constitution we have. The Swiss virtually copied the U.S. Constitution, but it is they created a weak president. So they rotate presidents every year, I think it is. And so the executive has executive powers, but he does not become a king. And the power in the Swiss government.
It lies with the cantons. And yet,
well, it lies in the cantons, and they
keep that right. Keep that regionalism powerful.
They keep the power in the voter's pocket. The voter is still in power, but the representative body still has power. Whereas in this country, look at the United States Congress has the only authority to issue money. They've given that up a long time ago, 80 years ago. The United States Congress is the only body that has the authority to declare war. They've given up that for a long time. And so that George, we've been in this war now for 4 years and longer. You know, the war in Iraq is actually now 16 years old. It'll be 16 years old this January.
Yeah.
It began in 19, if my math is right, it started in 1991 in January.
Mm-hmm.
And it never ended. People might think that it ended, but it never went a week in that period of the sanctions where the United States wasn't bombing some place in Iraq.
Yeah, but you know, when I look at the Swiss, okay, they're aware that their banks and their Zurich banks are holding, blood money, criminal money. They know it. So
yeah.
how do we square that circle? I mean, they may be in charge of the day-to-day operations of the country, but they're participating in some horrible things, and they're actually allowing it to prosper under their auspices. And not only that, they've provided sanctuary for people like Bremer to buy a multi-million-dollar home on Lake Geneva, along with George Bush Sr., who owns a house next to Bremer on a cul-de-sac. And I mean, yeah. And here, you know, so there is this virtually no place on earth anybody can go without getting away from these vomitous criminals.
Who did you say is Bremer's neighbor in Geneva?
It's George Bush Sr.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
And he used the money he stole from that original $3 billion he had over there that nobody could account for, and all of a sudden Bremer's got himself a nice place in Geneva.
Yeah, I don't doubt that for a minute. You know you remember when Ari Fleischer was George Bush's spokesperson,
Mr. Rabbi
Fleischer. What was interesting is that his brother became the person when the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, took over Iraq. His brother was the person in charge of selling off the assets of Iraq, and his brother's only claim to fame prior to that had been that he had a computer store in New Jersey. I mean, this is the thing, the criminal nature of this U.S. government is so in your face that the only way, it's mind-boggling. It's really mind-boggling. And what prosperity do you expect from a country led by such a criminal gang? You don't expect any prosperity except the prosperity that falls to them. And that's why, you know, it's true that it's going to be a sad day when the chickens come home to roost.
Well, I think that day's not long off. And
no.
You know, Chris, you're always welcome to come by and share your information with us. We've got so many subjects we could plumb. You know, if you'd like to come by on a weekly basis and just give us an update, I would love that. If you have
time, I'm going to try and do that. I've got to do more research. You see, that's a thing that I realized that there's very few people doing. Like I said, and I've just got to make connect the dots. But this Zionist criminal network in the United States is so vast. It's so vast that connecting these people. It requires a team. You know, we need to have a counterintelligence unit to, try and defend this country.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing to do because the American people have been kept very, very ignorant of Zionism. And
yeah.
You see, I wrote an article about Ehud Olmert's connection to 9/11 and I did a little bit of discussion about how the Americans are so ignorant about Zionism, political Zionism, its history. And it's interesting that that article was chosen not to be printed in my former newspaper.
No surprises there, huh?
Yeah.
No surprises.
Yeah.
Well, you know, next time we have you on, hopefully we'll have, you always have some good research. So I don't know what it is that you're going to research, Chris, but I know I want you to have it on the French Connection because it's powerful stuff every time. And, you know, you're always welcome here. And, of course, we're in touch regularly through Eric and whatnot. So I just want to tell you thanks for being on today. We went through a whole host of subjects, but all of them important, all of them connected.
Well, you know, you guys do great work, and you know, I was actually fired from American Free Press because they thought that I was you know, too close to you and Eric Hufschmid. I know you're in France and he's in California, but you know, we're of like mind. We're of like mind. We're thinking in the same way.
Yeah.
And I see no reason why I should dismiss you or Eric. I don't know your background. I don't know you intimately. I don't know you that well. I don't know your history. But we're speaking the same way, and you've done nothing.
Well, you know, I'm a good cook, don't you?
You've done good. You guys have
no, but you know I'm a good cook, Chris.
A good crook.
You've eaten at my house. You had turkey at my house. I'm a good cook.
Yeah. Oh, good cook. A good cook. Yeah, I know you're a good cook. I know you're a good cook. Well, thank you very much.
Well, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, Christopher Bolin, researcher, patriot, honest man, a friend of mine, and somebody that you need to pay more attention to and give your help to. We have a place on our site. If you feel the need to help Christopher out with his legal defense fund or any other part of his daily life that you might feel inclined to do, he's got his own section on the French Connections website, IamTheWitness.com. And as usual, Chris, you're invited back anytime you'd like to come back. I'll be in touch with you soon.
Thank you very much. We'll do it again.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Until the next time, be well. Bye-bye now.